It's Tuesday, March 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, Russia says it will pull out of Syria as peace talks continue.
If Donald Trump can sweep all five states, he would be well on his way to the Republican nomination.
Party nominations for the next U.S. president may essentially be set after the next round of voting. Also ahead, politics and the Supreme Court. The United States is driving oil prices, and Dr. Luke may be looking for a new record label. It's all on today's International Edition. Russian President Vladimir Putin has ordered the withdrawal of Russian forces from Syria as new UN-mediated peace talks on Syria began in Geneva. Russian state media quoted Putin Monday as telling his defense and foreign ministers that the tasks assigned to the defense ministry in Syria have been fulfilled. The Kremlin's website quoted Putin as telling Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in a phone conversation that he would withdraw the main part of the Russian Air Force contingent operating in Syria. In Damascus, the office of Syria's presidency said Assad agreed to the move, but added that Russia had promised that its Air Force contingent will not leave the country altogether. Russia's announcement comes as Syrian peace talks sponsored by Russia and the United States began Monday in Geneva. Those are the first talks in more than 2 years. However, the government and opposition remain at odds over a key issue. That's the future of President Bashar al-Assad. The main opposition High Negotiations Committee has indicated the talks should focus on creating a transitional governing body and Mr. Assad must leave. Syria analyst David Leitch of Trinity College in San Antonio, Texas, told VOA's Victor Beatty via Skype, Damascus, backed by Russia's air campaign, has no incentive now to compromise with a weakened opposition.
On the battlefield, they've made gains. Most of the international community, at least those that have been backing the opposition, have shown some flexibility regarding his position in any sort of transition process or flexibility regarding, you know, whether or not he can remain in power. So from his point of view, stay the course. I think before any negotiations anyhow, both sides are going to take maximalist positions and then leave open the possibility to negotiate. I think that's probably the opposition point of view. I think from the point of view of the Syrian regime, I mean, there's no way the negotiators are going to go there and negotiate the ouster of their boss. I mean, it's a non-starter from their point of view, as Syrian Foreign Minister Walid Mualim said. And I happen to know that, you know, in any sort of Syrian government negotiating team, you have those who are out front, but there are those with more power who are in the background. And they're the ones that, you know, really are pulling the strings on behalf of Bashar al-Assad. And they will keep Bashar al-Assad informed, and they'll make sure the negotiators who are in the public eye stay the course. So this is not surprising to me at all. I personally do not think the Syrian regime has any intention of stepping aside. And they have repeated the mantra, as has the Russians, that you know, it's up to the Syrian people to decide and not the subject of negotiations.
Are these doomed to fail?
If that becomes the sticking issue, if the Syrian opposition you know, holds to that position that, you know, they won't go any further without any guarantees that Assad will step down, it will go no further, and they will break down. And especially at this point in the game, in terms of Syrian government now being assertively backed by Russian military involvement and having made gains in the battlefield, there's no reason for them to make these sort of concessions from their point of view at this time.
Could this threaten the cessation of hostilities, in your view?
Absolutely, it could threaten it. I think what Secretary of State Kerry is doing is trying to pressure his Russian counterparts to compel the Syrian government negotiating team to be a little bit more flexible. But you know, I just don't see that happening right now.
David Leitch also believes the United States does not see Russian involvement in the conflict as open-ended, and given the upcoming U.S. election, believes it has some leverage with Moscow to get a political agreement done on Syria before November. Up next, we have our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee, in the studio to tell us online reaction to our top story. Hi, G.
Hello, Jim.
I saw a lot of breaking news tweets about it.
Absolutely. Reuters was one of the first to send out a tweet about it, and it reads like this. Breaking, Putin orders start a withdrawal of main part of Russian military force in Syria from Tuesday. Now, as you can imagine, many reporters responded to that news, and here's a couple of them. Michael Holmes with CNN International tweeted this. If Putin's troop withdrawal from Syria doesn't include aircraft, then does it mean anything? He's on Twitter at HomeCNN and based in Australia. Max Fisher, who is the foreign editor at Vox.com, tweeted, "We'll have to see if Russia follows through on that plan," but added, "It will be quite a vindication for diplomacy if it does, and Vox leans on the left and only available on the web."
Well, a lot of skepticism in general, I see. Turning to another topic, it's the eve of yet another Super Tuesday vote here in the United States. So what are the presidential hopefuls tweeting?
Well, let's start with Marco Rubio, who is really banking on his home state of Florida to turn the tide around. He tweeted, "This election is the most important in a generation. In Florida, you have an important role to play. Hashtag FL primary." But Donald Trump is still the leading Republican contender, who tweeted, "We don't have a country if we don't have borders." That tweet, of course, is in relation to his building a wall idea between the U.S. and Mexico.
Any noticeable tweets from the Democratic side?
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is focusing on tackling the fossil fuel industry. His plan is to provide $41 billion in transition assistance to all fossil fuel workers, not just coal workers. Secretary Hillary Clinton, for her part, sent out two tweets about her appearance on a talk show earlier today. She talked about the Flint water crisis, emphasizing that if it happened in Detroit, the situation would have been handled immediately. That's all for me today, Jim.
Well, thanks for the analysis, G. And you may follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I also post several times daily as well at VOA Stevenson. And be sure to follow our International Edition news stream. It's at VOA_IE. You can check it out any time of the day or night that you like. Well, now that we've covered some of the social media sentiment of U.S. politics, let's get to what's at stake in this very important juncture on the road to the White House. VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone shares the highlights with my International Edition colleague, Susan Yockey.
Five big states are voting. It'll affect both party candidates. Particularly, we're looking at the Republican race right now. There's two states to watch, Ohio and Florida. If Donald Trump can sweep all five states, he would be well on his way to the Republican nomination. It looks like the biggest challenge to Trump on Tuesday will come in Ohio. That's where the home state governor, John Kasich, is running well, according to the latest public opinion polls. That's a close race. The other state, Florida, 99 Republican delegates at stake. Both Ohio and Florida are winner-take-all, so you just win the popular vote, you get all the delegates. And the polling right now shows a big advantage for Trump, double digits ahead of Marco Rubio. If Rubio does not really win in Florida on Tuesday, I'm sure there'll be a lot of calls for him to get out of the race.
What about the Democrats?
Well, we have the same five states featuring the Democratic contest. Hillary Clinton is leading, according to the polls, in most of those, particularly in Florida, also in Ohio. It looks like Illinois, which is another of the states voting on Tuesday, there's a fairly narrow gap there between Clinton and her main challenger, Bernie Sanders. So Sanders surprised in Michigan last week. He was well down in the polls. Who knows? We could see more surprises on Tuesday.
Well, meanwhile, candidates from both parties are giving a hard time to Republican frontrunner Donald Trump. And that's because of all the violence that has erupted at his rallies, even though he denies there's a lot of violence. The cameras show us people punching each other and jumping around and being taken out of the venues.
Yeah, we had a Friday night rally in Chicago that was canceled. Trump canceled it after stirring protests, at the venue. Kansas City, there were protests inside and outside the debate or the speech venue where he spoke. It's taken a really kind of serious turn over the last several days. Now, Sunday and so far on Monday, it's been a little calmer. But I think this does have, especially members of the Republican establishment, a little concerned. Trump is defiant in these rallies, is blaming outside agitators for causing the demonstrations.
He even mentioned Sanders.
Yeah, he's even mentioned Bernie Sanders. Sanders says that Trump is a pathological liar. So the elevation of debate hasn't really happened, and we are seeing these disturbances. We'll see if they continue. If they do, it's going to give the Republicans pause. even at the moment when it looks as though Trump is moving toward the nomination.
Well, be sure to listen to International Edition at this time tomorrow as we learn together some of the answers to the questions that Jim Malone just raised. And we'll be right here as results are coming in and several of the state results are announced. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. The U.S. political struggle continues in Washington, far from the presidential campaigning in states across the country. A Supreme Court vacancy remains to be filled in the wake of the death of Antonin Scalia. It's a battle between the White House and Senate Republicans. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman joins us as concerns are growing that this ideological struggle could spill into the general election in November.
Jim, President Obama could nominate someone at any moment. The rumors swirling around the White House is that he's whittled down his list of candidates to about three. And the names that are mentioned are all considered to be judicial moderates. In other words, none of them, if President Obama were to pick them, none of them would be sort of the liberal equivalent of Antonin Scalia. In fact, none of them would be as liberal as Ruth Bader Ginsburg, as Elena Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor, any of them. They are considered to be very much middle-of-the-road jurists. Now, I should say that sometimes people come to the Supreme Court with a reputation for being liberal, moderate, conservative, and they confound those expectations once they're on the court. But none of the people who are rumored to be on Obama's final list are thought to be straying too far from the sort of judicial center of gravity within this country. And that seems to be the strategy. And in fact, there are Republicans who have taken note of this. And this is where the presidential election could play a role in how this Supreme Court nomination ultimately plays out. Because if Republicans fear that they're going to lose the White House, that it is almost a foregone conclusion that there will not be a Republican entering the White House in 2017, then the question becomes, who would a Democrat nominate? Who would President Obama's successor nominate at the beginning of a four-year term with a mandate from the people? And Republican Senator Lindsey Graham last week, in open hearing, speaking to his Republican colleagues on the Judiciary Committee, said, look, President Obama is likely to name a moderate, but Hillary Clinton, if she comes in, is going to nominate a true dyed-in-the-wool liberal. And maybe this strategy that we're pursuing isn't the smartest, best thought out thing. I don't know how this is going to play out. Right now, Republicans are almost to a person sticking with the message that no one that comes from the Obama White House is even going to be considered, is even going to have doors opened for them in the Senate office buildings, is not going to have a confirmation hearing, and certainly is not going to have any vote on the Senate floor. The White House and Democrats are banking that once someone comes forward, once there's an actual nominee, someone in flesh and blood, that what is easy to say in abstract, we're not going to consider anyone, will be much more difficult in practice when there's a real human being walking over to the Capitol, or at least going in in a limousine over to the Capitol, and walking the halls and showing up at senators' offices. I really can't wait to see how this plays out.
You mentioned the comments by Senator Graham, and that's rather striking because these are usually things that are said behind closed doors, not so much out in the open where hey, you know what? We might be better off now than if somebody else gets into the White House.
It was an unusual moment. And he was not reading from the Republican script.
Right.
And I could only imagine the blood pressure of his fellow Republicans on the Judiciary Committee spiking just a bit as he was speaking. But nothing that he said is anything that hasn't occurred to any reporter who's up on Capitol Hill. What is the game here? And if, in fact, this blockade of an Obama Supreme Court pick puts vulnerable Senate Republicans, Republicans who are in traditionally blue states, mm-hmm. at risk as they're seeking their reelection, and if it puts the Republican majority in the Senate at risk, is that really something that Republicans will allow to play out? There are a lot of moving pieces to this, and we'll just have to see.
A lot of intrigue in the political strategy with Michael Bowman. He's our VOA Senate correspondent. And Michael, thanks so much for stopping by.
Always a pleasure, Jim. Thanks.
One issue American voters are not too concerned with right now is the high prices at the gas pump. In fact, the price of oil has crept up just slightly in recent days. Some analysts feel that it may have actually bottomed out. That's pretty good news for oil producers around the world, but its production in the United States is what continues to drive the market. Maria Gallucci from International Business Times joins us to explain.
The International Energy Agency last week said that oil prices might have already bottomed out at around $28 a barrel earlier this year because oil production is starting to decline and demand is holding steady. And so there's this hope that this big glut of crude supplies, which is what has kept prices down for so long, is finally starting to ease, although it's very early days for this.
About what type of supply are we talking about as far as the United States is concerned?
Well, the United States actually has been a major driver in the trends in the oil market over the last couple of years. We saw in recent years this huge surge in production to kind of levels not seen since the 1970s, thanks in large part to the fracking boom, the hydraulic fracturing boom across shale formations. Well, with the surge in production, that helped drive prices down, and now many U.S. drillers have found it hard financially to keep drilling. So production is kind of starting to fall. And in that way, the U.S. has helped push down prices with its rising production. And now prices are starting to ease a little bit as U.S. production is sliding.
There was some call from OPEC of possibly reducing oil output on their end. They continued to produce, as well as the Iranians coming on board following the nuclear deal. So a lot of oil is still being produced. And I would imagine that's having a profound effect on U.S. suppliers.
Right, exactly. And what's happening, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, Russia, they agreed to freeze their production to January levels, which were kind of an all-time high for some of those countries. So they won't cut production. They might freeze production, but only if other countries get on board. So effectively, a lot of analysts have very little expectation that anything will actually happen. But these oil-producing countries have a different market than the U.S., which is made up of hundreds or thousands of independent companies who respond entirely to price and not policy. And that's why kind of the U.S. is the first to fall and is falling more significantly than other nations.
The U.S. production is beginning to be exported, but not so much in a large quantity. Most of the production from the United States side is used here. Is that correct?
That's correct. For the last 40 years, there was a ban on U.S. crude oil exports. That ban was put in place during the height of sort of the 1970s Arab oil embargo when there were concerns that the U.S. wouldn't have enough of its own supplies. But President Obama lifted that in December, and the U.S. has slowly begun exporting crude oil again. But again, like you said, just a trickle at this point.
How much does the United States rely on imports at this point?
The U.S. continues to rely on its imports to some extent. That number has declined in recent years as domestic production has increased, but it's certainly a less significant share than it was before the fracking boom.
As the smaller producers in the United States who mostly are in the fracking business have been squeezed in recent months, how are they adjusting to this? Are some just going out of business? Are they reducing their capacity to produce? What's happening with them?
Right, you see a real mix across the oil patch, because some companies that kind of were in a smarter financial position or happen to be in particular areas of Texas are able to compete at these really low oil prices of $30, $40 a barrel. But many other companies took on way too much debt before prices collapsed, and now, you know, they're grappling with that. Dozens have filed for bankruptcy. More could file for bankruptcy this year. Tens of thousands of people have been laid off. And what a lot of producers have done is, in places where they already have a lease, they've gone ahead and drilled the oil or natural gas well because they don't want to lose their lease, but they're not producing anything. So there's about 4,000 wells across the U.S. that are ready to be tapped but are completely on hold now because it's not just not profitable to turn them on right now.
Maria Gallucci is the International Business Times energy and environment reporter. Thank you so much, Maria, for bringing us up to date.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Representatives for producer Dr. Luke have denied that Sony Music will be ending its relationship with him after allegations of sexual abuse emerged in a court case involving pop rocker Keisha. International Edition's David Byrd and VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee talk about how Keisha's case has raised the specter of sexism and mistreatment of women in the music business.
She alleges that he was psychologically abusive, and then the lawsuit, she also claimed that he drugged and raped her. And this has been going on now for over a year. Recently, and this was probably in the last few weeks or so, Keisha was in court. She was asking to be released from her contract from Kemosabe Records, which is Dr. Luke's label on Sony. But the judge denied the preliminary injunction. So she was not allowed to be released from her contract. But Sony said, you can work, but just not with Dr. Luke. She has six more albums that she's required to complete for Kemosabe and also for Sony. And as a result of this, quite a few very powerful women in the industry have come out.
Including people like Kelly Clarkson.
Right, have come out in support of her. Taylor Swift, I think, gave her $250,000 for her legal fees. Lady Gaga has come out publicly in support of her. Adele has come out publicly in support of her. And Kelly Clarkson, who was interviewed in Australia, said, hey, he's not a very nice guy. I had to work with him. I didn't want to, but Sony insisted. In fact, they blackmailed me. Those were her words. So there are some reports now that Sony plans to end their relationship with Dr. Luke ahead of their the expiration date of the contract, which will be sometime next year. Now, Sony has not confirmed nor denied this, but these are the reports, and people are speculating that this is probably because this has become a PR nightmare for the label, for Sony.
And Sony doesn't like bad PR. I mean, it's like, we want everything to stay stable. We want everybody to be happy, and mm-hmm. let's all get along. Because
right.
in the end, Sony is not in business to make artists happy, even though making the artist happy is important.
Yeah.
Sony is in business to sell CDs or downloads or vinyl records or whatever format you choose to consume their music on. And anything that interrupts that process, it's just like the Takata airbag thing with Honda.
Mm.
Honda had to call back a whole bunch of cars because there was something wrong with the cars, and they don't want their brand
being associated with something bad. Am I right in that?
You're absolutely right. And that's exactly what's happened. I mean, this is a huge story, not only in the pop music world, but folks who are inside the music industry are watching this very closely, because this is one of the first times where we've actually seen the inner workings of the industry. There are other artists who have come out, not against Dr. Luke, but other female artists who have come out to say, you know, this is kind of par for the course. And so Kesha has become sort of a shero for many of the women in the industry. Now, I think it's very important, however, to say that Dr. Luke denies all of the allegations. And Sony, a representative for Sony, came out to say, we have no evidence that what Kesha is alleging is actually true. So right now, it really is he said, she said.
Okay, well, that's where we'll have to leave it for right now. If you have any comments on this, you can send Shauna a tweet. She's at VOA Lady DJ. You can also hit her up at VOA underscore music. And you can look for her show, The Soul Lounge, on our website, voanews.com.
Oh, things can get so complicated. It's not complicated to stay up to date when you listen to International Edition every day. We're so glad that you could stop by and spend a little time with us today. You can always find us at our website, voanews.com. Follow us on Twitter, the handle at VOA underscore IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Chaz Hall. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thanks again for joining us. We hope you have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The periodic warming of sea surface temperatures in the Pacific Ocean, known as El Niño, causes weather and short-term climate changes in other parts of the globe. The El Niño of 2015-2016 is the strongest on record, and nowhere have been extreme weather effects associated with El Niño been more intensely felt than in Ethiopia. Last summer's Kirimt, or main rainy season, has been weak, and the short spring bell grains are delayed. According to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, the resulting drought, the worst Ethiopia has experienced in 5 decades, has led to successive crop failures and widespread livestock deaths, tripling the humanitarian needs. Some 10.2 million Ethiopians are now chronically hungry, while some 7.5 million farmers and herders need immediate agricultural support to produce both grains and livestock in the coming season. Since October 2014, the United States has provided over $500 million in aid to Ethiopia and another $4 million worth of seeds, a critical need for farmers, given that the planting season will begin soon. But this year, we are taking an extra step, one we feel is necessary if we are to prevent this crisis from growing much, much worse. Instead of waiting for the situation to develop into a full-blown emergency, we are sending in a disaster assistance response team, a group of experts that will evaluate the situation on the ground, pinpoint gaps in the aid plan, and accelerate and expand the emergency response, said USAID Administrator Gail Smith. We are moving earlier in this case because we have found that there is real agreement between donors, NGOs, the government, and UN agencies that if we move very, very quickly, we can avert the worst impacts of this drought. We hope that by taking this step, we will lead the rest of the international community, said Administrator Smith. If we move now, if other donors move with us, we think we can do 2 things. Avert the worst impacts and protect some of the development gains that the country has made over many years, she said. We are challenging the world not just to respond to human suffering, but to respond quickly enough to prevent something even worse.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
is for, what's